action where you beat against yourself. Is that not the one you suffered? Okay. No, thank you so much. We have Mr. Appan from the Department of Energy, and without much ado, I'm going to hand over to Mr. Appan. First, the apologies.
Thank you, sir. We've received the following apologies from Honorable Khadebe, who's preparing his debate speech for this afternoon, higher education. Also, an apology from Mr. Ross, who's attending the Standing Committee on Finance meeting. Then also an apology from the Minister, who will be attending the Select Committee on Education, will be dealing with the strategic plan and budget vote. Also an apology from the DG, who's attending the Clean Energy Ministerial meeting on behalf of the Minister in London. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you so much. Mr. Appani, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. My name is Ombi Appani. I am accompanied today by my colleague, Mr. Sandile Mpanzi from the Director General's Office, and we will be taking you through a very short presentation today on the Renewable Energy IPP program. So, honorable Chair, without much ado, I'm going to go straight into it. Perhaps just to give some context before I go into the slide presentation is that the integrated resource plan made provision for some 18,000 megawatts of renewable energy technologies to be introduced in the period from as soon as possible until 2030. And there had been some debate as to the best approach to dealing with the implementation of that aspiration to introduce renewable energy. And honorable members would recall that perhaps this time last year, just as we were concluding the integrated resource plan, one of the biggest challenges we faced was how we were going to introduce the renewable energy feed-in tariff, the REFIT, as it was called then. We had then moved away from the concept of REFIT for a number of reasons, amid a lot of controversy, I must indicate, and I'm not going to dwell on that. Safe to say that we're now taking the matter forward from that position. In other words, since the time that we introduced the renewable the integrated resource plan with that aspiration, what has then happened? And that's the context of the presentation today. First of all, the law requires that the minister must determine that there is a need for new generation capacity. And as the minister determines, the minister must get the concurrence of the regulator. So in other words, it must be very clear in independent eyes, as it were, that there is indeed a need for the new generation capacity. The minister then, in accordance with the integrated resource plan, determined some 3,800 megawatts would be required. 3,825 megawatts, of which 100 megawatts of that would have been the allocation to ESCOM, right? So we call it 3,725 megawatts because there is 100 megawatts that was provided for by ESCOM. Secondly, the minister determined that the 3,725 megawatts shall be done by independent power producers. So in other words, that it will not be ESCOM that procures or develops the 3,700 megawatts, but that it would be done through independent power producers in line with the provisions of the Electricity Regulation Act. We indicate there that within the 3,725 megawatts, provision was made for 100 megawatts of small projects. Small projects are defined as those projects that are equal to or less than 5 megawatts in capacity, and these projects are specifically earmarked for certain technologies that lend themselves more for rural development, distributed generation, and participation by, you know, small companies. And maybe at this point I should also indicate that we have yet to launch the small projects program, in other words, relating to that 100 megawatt. So the subject of today is going to be largely around the 3,725 megawatts, excluding the 100 megawatts of small projects, which will follow later. Lastly, in relation to the determination, was that it provided for technologies in wind, solar PV, solar CSP, biomass, landfill gas, small hydro. Yes, those are the technologies that were provided for in terms of the determination. And documentation was prepared in order for that to be procured. And as I have already indicated, sans the 100 megawatts of small projects. On the 3rd of August last year, we released the procurement documentation, and we had a very rigorous bidders conference in order to go through the provisions of those documentation and to give prospective bidders an opportunity to engage and to raise those questions that would have been unclear. Maybe to also indicate that parallel to that, or maybe even before that, before the bidders conference, behind closed doors, as it were, a lot of consultation with lenders regarding the risk allocation in the different documentation in order to make sure that these projects or that the procurement processes had a strong chance of being bankable. You would recall that our history as a country, particularly in that space, is fraught with examples where projects had not been bankable because lenders had had lots of concern about the risk allocation in those documentation. So we were quite comfortable that that had been resolved, and we engaged the prospective bidders. To also indicate that the bidding covered a number of what we call windows. Right. We had designed the procurement process to accommodate five bidding rounds or five windows for a number of strategic reasons. First of all was that, notwithstanding the fact that we had tested this with lenders, we wanted to be confident that if there were certain mistakes that would have become apparent in the first window, we would use the second and the subsequent windows to correct those kind of mistakes. And again, of relevance here was the whole, you know, controversy around why this was not a refit program, but rather a competitive bidding process based on price and other elements. So, in relation to those windows, it was made very clear that the first and the second windows, the first, the second, and the third windows would be under this procurement process. In other words, that the rules that would apply for the first, second, and third windows would be designed on the 3rd of August, or would apply from the 3rd of August process, and that if necessary, the rules for windows 4 and 5 would be communicated later. The relevance of this point here is that there is some confusion out there, because once the first window had been opened up and the bids had been received and closed, there were a number of other prospective bidders who had wanted to submit bids for the second window without having registered, you know, by the 3rd of August and so on, and that had been a breach of the rules, so it was indicated to them that they needed to, you know, wait until the other windows were open. Okay, just a little bit of detail in case anybody was wondering why the reference to the first and second windows. So just to summarize, is that we released the documents on the 3rd of August, and then within a month We had the bidders conference, and then the bids closed in November. On the 4th of November, we received 53 bids in the different technologies, mainly focusing on wind, solar PV, and CSP. Perhaps we need to indicate that we did not receive any bids in relation to the landfill gas, biomass, and so on. The smaller project is not cause for concern at this point, particularly because they tend to be much smaller capacity projects rather than, well, in relation to, in comparison to the wind and the and the solar technologies.
Yes.
Solar CSP. CSP concentrating solar power. Okay. I will go into a little bit of detail around the evaluation and the, if you like, the measures that have been put in place to make sure that we maintain the integrity of the procurement process, the evaluation, and the adjudication, you know, in a manner that does not lend itself towards a challenge or any of that kind of controversy. At this point, just to indicate that the evaluation was conducted off-site, so in other words, it was not done within the department. It was done at Gallagher Estate, where a wing of the Gallagher Estate was secured and dedicated towards the evaluation of this. Just to give you some context, we're talking here of a 50 billion rand procurement process. You know, so it is bigger than any of these projects or programs that are out there at this point. Save perhaps for the Eskom Medupi and Kusile procurement process. So it was quite important that we ensure that, you know, we do not attract unnecessary controversy through that. So offshore, and it is done under 24-hour surveillance, both in relation to voice and visual. So in other words, only certain people are allowed to enter, and even those that enter, everything that they say, everything that they do goes on tape and people can see. You're not allowed to enter with any laptops, no pen, no paper, no cell phone. Right? So everything happens inside there. We have a secure network. That server functions as the only medium for the repository or the recording of all the proceedings. And people go in there in the morning, everything they do inside, they leave it there, there are no notes allowed, etc. You know, so that's the nature of the security measures that we have put in place. And I suppose it also gives some sense as to why it was done offshore and not in the department, because otherwise it would disrupt the normal business of the department. Okay, now just some detail regarding the procurement process itself, particularly against the background of the refit. Just to recap, the renewable energy feed-in tariff contemplated a scenario in terms of which there would be no price competition. It would be on a first-come, first-serve basis, that anybody that was ready to provide the technology would enter into a contract on the basis that they had met, you know, the other, shall we say, technical, financing, and commercial requirements. But there would not be any price, you know, competition as such. Instead, what would happen is that the price cap, right, the extent to which we would be paying for every megawatt hour that was produced by this technology would have been predetermined, right? And it would be predetermined on some basis that was not necessarily competitive. We had moved away from that, as I indicated, for a number of reasons, and we can still debate as to the merits of having done that. But with hindsight, we're actually quite very glad that we have done that. But at this point, you know, there was a bit of a problem as to how you now commission is split into three broad agreements, if you like. The first one is the request for proposal, which is an agreement that spells out and outlines all the bidding rules that prospective bidders have to enter into. So you sign your request for proposal in order to demonstrate that you have understood and you agree to abide by those rules as a condition for bidding. The second one is in relation to the power purchase agreement or the offtake agreement, and I'll come back to some of these things in a little bit more detail. But the power purchase agreement is the one that had been negotiated with Eskom, the offtaker, the ultimate, you know, user of the energy, and the power purchase agreement, right, were in respect of those different technologies, you know, wind, solar, CSP. And the power purchase agreement was designed to be a 20-year agreement on what one would call a take-and-pay basis. Now, just to explain what it means is that because wind, solar PV, and such technologies are non-dispatchable. In other words, you cannot order the wind, you cannot order the sun in the same way that you can order energy from a coal-fired power station. So when the wind blows, it blows. When it doesn't blow, it doesn't blow. So there's no energy to be had. So the design of the power purchase agreement was such that at any point when the wind or the sun produced energy, it would be paid for. So there would be some assessment or a quantification of the amount of energy that was paid, and that would be paid according to the tariff that was designed. Now, contrast this to what normally happens with coal-fired power stations, nuclear, and so on. There we do not pay only for the energy that is produced, we also pay for the capacity that gets built. And it is in the nature of the market that we have in South Africa. It's the fact that nobody is going to take any investment risk where there was uncertainty around dispatchability. Now, in simple language, what it means is that on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, actually on a 30-minute, on an instantaneous basis, the system operator, and I'm glad that we will be bringing the matter to this committee in due course next month, the system operator has to determine which power station gets called up in order to meet the demand as the demand changes. Right? So instantaneously the demand has to be met, and it is the system operator's prerogative to determine which plant gets called up to meet that demand. Now, in the context of, let's call it, 27 power stations, more or less, owned by Eskom, plus another X number owned by independent power producers, it is quite conceivable that the system operator might call only certain power stations and not others, which would then render those power stations unbankable or unviable, simply because there would be stranded investments, you know, with no cash flows attached to them to redeem the investment that had been made. And I think that's the point I'm trying to explain here, that if you think about it, we have that particular problem where the nature, the timing, and the decisions around who gets dispatched, for what periods do they get dispatched, and so on, to the extent that that is still within one integrated entity, Eskom, it creates that sense, right, rightfully or wrongfully, that it could be against the interests of those that are non-Eskom and those that are new. So to overcome that, just to summarize, is that we designed the power purchase agreement to be on a non-dispatchable kind of basis. So in other words, if the power is produced from that wind or solar or CSP plant, Eskom has to pay, right? As a first option, the power plant the last part of the agreement, the last part of the agreement that we put in place, or the last agreement, is what we call the implementation agreement. And this is largely an agreement that warehouses all the other conditionalities that are not necessarily commercial that government wants to factor into this process. And those agreements, for example, relate to managing the risks, ensuring that we have local economic development, matters like black economic empowerment, and so on, are hardwired into this agreement. And that agreement is then undertaken between the department and the prospective independent power producer. Of importance around the implementation agreement is the fact that whilst it is a separate and seemingly unnecessary agreement, it could also lead to termination in the event that the independent power producer or the contracting party did not meet their obligations. And we, in hindsight, we think that this is perhaps the biggest value that this procurement process could add to our objectives. The fact that, you know, there is this risk, there is this, if you like, big stick that looms in relation to these contracts that we have entered into. And yes, you might be producing the power and so on, but if you do not produce your goods and services locally, if you do not train people, if you do not employ people, and you import everything, etc., you run the risk that we might cancel the contract, and then you would lose out. And that's the way that we enforce the what we call the local economic development aspects of this process. Obviously, there is the other side as well, you know, in relation to not the IPP breaching, but government breaching the provisions of the agreement. In that event, should that happen, then the department would provide or would produce warranties to the extent, or produce warranties to the extent that, that we would pay up. So that's the nature of the agreements that we have put in place in relation to the procurement. Lastly, just around the rules in the request for proposals, is that the normal rules apply in Part A. In Part B, we include what we call qualification criteria. So in other words, it is not everybody who is allowed to bid under this program. Certain people who qualify would be assessed in relation to Part B of the documentation, and only those that met the rules and qualified would then be assessed in respect of Part C, which is the part that I just mentioned now, the economic development criteria. In economic development, we collaborated a lot with the Department of Trade and Industry around the opportunities to localize a lot of these technologies, or not a lot, but I mean some of the aspects of these technologies. For example, there is a sense that with solar technology, South Africa has a certain strategic advantage given our high solar irradiation levels in this country. You know, people make reference to the fact that even KZN has solar irradiation levels that are better than certain parts of Spain where solar water, solar power plants have been built. And there is a sense that we need to take advantage of those kind of attributes in South Africa, and solar PV has therefore become a specific, you know, focus area in terms of our industrial development. And the same with wind. There is a sense that there are certain industries in South Africa that could be customized to take advantage of the manufacture of some of these components that go into wind turbines and so on and so forth. So some analysis was done, and then targets were set in respect of the local content that bidders had to comply with. And it was a competitive kind of process. So for example, where everything was equal and one guy was going to produce 60% of his technology locally, as opposed to somebody who was only going to be 40%, that we would defer to the one that had a higher local content. I hope that it's become clear, but we'll take questions down the line. Okay, I think I've touched a lot on that. In terms of Part A, what the rules are fairly standard, as you might appreciate. You know, there is a time element to this. You have to submit bids in a particular form. You have to sign all the documentation. If you do this, you find. If you do that, that's not allowed. You'll be disqualified, and so on and so forth. Right? So that's Part A. Just in terms of the elements that we assessed for pre-qualification in Part B, environment was the first one. And in respect of environment, I think it speaks for itself that we do not want to have a situation where, you know, this renewable energy program undermined, you know, the very essence of its introduction, which is the fact that we have a greenhouse gas emissions, which is more, you know, than an environmental problem, but that you did not want in the process of pursuant to a greener electricity production portfolio that you flouted environmental law. So we would assess the different technologies or the different projects in respect of environmental, you know, provisions that that prevail. More importantly is that we made it a pre-requirement that if you did not have an environmental authorization, you would not be allowed to take part in this process. Right? So that's the point about it. Then the issue around the land, and I'm not going to go into too much detail around each of those because it's very detailed. Around the land, it also speaks for itself. There are certain issues around land use that we have to watch. You know, and food security is a key consideration. We have to make sure that suddenly we do not create, you know, an energy opportunity out of or at the expense of food security, where a land that was normally suitable for food production was turned into, you know, solar and wind power stations. Okay, I think the rest speaks they speak for themselves. If I can maybe just reflect on the second last one, which is price. The fact that, as I've already indicated, we did not then prescribe a price, you know, for you. We required the bidders to indicate the price at which they would be prepared to produce the power, and in line with a particular financial model that would have been compulsory to complete. So we'd be able to see what price you were proposing, but also what underpinned that price, so that we could see, you know, whether there was value for money. And I must say, it was very eye-opening, and one of the reasons that we are quite comfortable that we had not gone the route of a refit. And down the line, honourable members, you will understand where we're coming from. Now, for those bidders who would have made Part A or complied with Part A, met all the qualification requirements under Part B, they would then go into Part C, which is where the real competition starts. So Part A and B are mainly about compliance, and Part C are around the competition. And they would compete on the basis of certain weighting being allocated to each of those elements we reflect there. Price, obviously a very big component. Maybe just to indicate that in respect of price, we had also secured an exemption from the PPPFA, the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act. We had obtained exemption from that. Just to recap, the PPPFA provides that if procurement is above 500,000, then you're supposed to use a 90-10 rule, and if the procurement is less than 500,000, it's an 80-20 rule. And as you can understand, in this context, we'll be procuring much more than 500,000, and we were then required by law to use the 90-10 rule, and we did not want to use the 90-10 rule, because the 90-10 rule says price is 90%, and 10% is the so-called objective criteria. So in this case, we had then introduced a whole lot of other objective criteria outside of price, which carried a lot more weight than the 10%, and those would have been the things that government wants to drive. For example, jobs, right? So the number of jobs at construction stage and over the life cycle of your project is a competitive criterion. So people would compete on that. And so that the list goes down. Local content, ownership. Ownership, there was a requirement that each and every one of these projects must be at least 40% South African owned. Right? So in other words, if somebody would propose a project that was less than 40% South African ownership, they would be disqualified. But those that were above 40% would then have to compete on the next element of that ownership. And that element is in relation to black economic empowerment. So within that 40%, there was a competition as to the extent to which you could score maximum points. So those that were 40% owned, and it was BEE 100%, would score better than those that were 40% South African but were not BEE. And so on. Then management control. This is also in line with the famous code that I'm sure you're familiar with. So what happened here is that we adjusted the codes, having secured an exemption from the PPPFA, we adjusted the codes as indicated, you know, with certain ways, in order to come to some, if you like, peculiar, you know, renewable energy IPP outcome. And I'm speaking confidently, Chair, because we understand the outcome now, and it's a very good outcome, so that's why I speak like this. It's not because we don't know. Just in terms of the evaluation itself, so in other words, having received that, remember I indicated that we received the bids, and those that recall the 4th of November, we closed, and then we announced the preferred bidders during COP17. And the turnaround was in about 3 weeks, which was a record, incidentally. And we're quite happy to also indicate that as far as the post-mortem, there is absolutely no risk in relation to any mistake that might have been made pursuant to a fast-tracked evaluation program. Evaluation also hardwired into the documentation, so it was approved up front. A template was developed, and everybody knew what they would be evaluating even before it was evaluated. So in other words, in order to avoid this fiddling with the evaluation to suit certain, you know, preferred bidders, you know, the evaluation template was adopted up front, signed off, and that was the basis that was used. And even more than that, there was a template, because as you can imagine, the evaluators were, well, I'll come into that, but they had different streams, you know, you had technical, financial, legal, and so on and so forth. So each and every one of them worked according to the same template in the evaluation of that. They were also trained, right? So in other words, this was not just a question of getting people in and then saying this is it. There was a training process around how you evaluate in the different disciplines and in the use of this specific template that was designed. Over and above that, the evaluators were moderated. There was another level regarding finance, as I mentioned, there was that competition on price, and there was a requirement that a financial model was submitted. We had to make sure that there were no mistakes in the financial models that were submitted, and cross-moderation specifically in relation to finance happened, which means that, for example, we would swap, you know, the moderators, the evaluators, in order to make sure that each and everyone was able to review the work that the others were done. I'm not going to go into detail, but just to indicate here the composition. Firstly, the streams. As I indicated, we had environment, right, a specific stream that looked at environmental issues. Then the land issues, commercial and legal, economic development, financial and technical. So there were six different streams of people or experts that would be looking at the different elements of competition within the RFP. Maybe to just go into some or to elaborate a little bit, because I think there might be questions down the line. I'm not going to go into the names of those. I think this is just for your information, right? In respect of the environment, firstly was the issue of the land rights. Right? There are issues around land and rights around that. And as you would appreciate, there's an overlap between environment and land. So the environmental experts would look at the project from an environmental bias, even though there was land involved, and then there would be specific issues that we would look at in respect of the land issues. Right? Land rights, and then the application for land use. I did mention here that food security is a big issue, and you would have to convert the land into this new use that you were proposing, in other words, be it solar or wind, and therefore you had to follow a specific process around that. In relation to municipalities, okay, maybe before that, just to indicate that, maybe not. The issue around the land that was used or that has been used for purposes of developing renewable energy projects, there is a particular pattern that is emerging, and that pattern is mainly related to those farmers who own the land, and that land might have been largely used for agricultural purposes, and some of the land that had been when the land is not being used, and relating to fallow land, not a problem, but we found that a lot of very good land for agricultural purposes was now being punted or proposed for development of power projects, to the extent that it really upset the Department of Land Affairs and Agriculture, you know, for food security purposes. We then found another pattern emerging where people then deferred to municipal land in order to try and put their projects on those. And specifically in relation to municipal land, there are certain processes that are prescribed in various local government legislation, particularly the Municipal Finance Management Act. There's also a slew of legislation around how you alienate municipal land, and we found that a lot of the developers did not understand that. They thought it was just a simple matter of getting a council resolution and off you would go. Right? So we would check that in detail. Then another issue in relation to environment is the right over land, the so-called right over land. What we're finding is that one of the biggest challenges South Africa is going to have to deal with as it develops its infrastructure is how one deals with accessing, you know, land for purposes of the common good. And I'm talking here in terms of distribution and transmission lines that has to cross farmland or privately owned land, and ensuring that, you know, there was, if you like, due recognition of the common good in that process. Right? Our expropriation regime is a little bit out of date, and there's a lesson that we learned, so I'm digressing a little bit. But our expropriation regime is based on a very old statute and we found that it did not, you know, made for a very easy process in relation to or in respect of right overlap. And we specifically looked at some of those risks in relation to that. I'm not going to go too much into the land. It takes a little, get a little bit technical, but for example, one wanted to understand that the land was not encumbered for other purposes, so we would want to have some sort of material due diligence to ensure that the land that was being applied for could be used for that purpose. The lawyers, you know, would assess the extent to which bidders qualified the power purchase agreement. Incidentally, one of the conditions of bidding was that we would prescribe a power purchase agreement. As I already indicated, it had been negotiated and accepted by ESCOM and the regulator. And where bidders tried to change the provisions in the power purchase agreement, that would immediately disqualify them. So you had to accept that upfront, and there were certain, you know, representations that you had to make in order to do that. Then we also needed to look at the project structure itself. So in other words, the developer had to indicate, you know, who was who in the zoo, you know, who is the main developer, who are the partners, what sort of attributes do they have, particularly relating to, you know, technical capacity, financial resources, and just their ability to bring such projects to bear. So there was a process in terms of which we do that. I think the last thing I would like to go into is the economic development aspects, because we really did go to town around that. Firstly was that there were certain thresholds, right? And those thresholds were peculiar to the different technologies. There were the thresholds around solar PV and thresholds around wind and so forth. Firstly, one had to comply with those thresholds. So we would specifically look at the extent to which you had complied with those thresholds, and then secondly would look at a comparator in relation to everybody else that had qualified. And I've already indicated that if you go into detail, this is perhaps the trump card for us in this process, that we really went to town around ensuring that economic development issues were not on the basis of a trickle-down effect. Right? And I want to stress that it's on the basis that it is a requirement, and if you do not meet the requirement, you run the risk, A, that you would be disqualified and we would cash your bid bond. Alternatively, if you tried any tricks in the life cycle of the project, we would terminate the contract. So it's not like, you know, I could have created jobs, but by the way, I have this kind of problem. It's your risk, and you know, we don't prescribe to you except for those thresholds. You indicate what you're going to do pursuant to economic development, and we hold you accountable for those. If I can maybe just move on and indicate that what then happened is that this is the outcome of the bids that we received. 28 were recognized as passing bids. In other words, they could move to preferred bidder status with the attributes as indicated there. Between the different technologies, you would see that biomass, biogas, landfill gas, small hydro was not allocated, mainly because there were no bids that were received. 43% went into solar PV in the first window, and 1,415 megawatts was deemed to be bankable. In other words, succeeded at the evaluation process in window one, and was then allocated according to those percentages that I indicated there. Basically, for example, where we say that 75% of CSP, what we mean is that there were, we had made an allocation in the IRP in this window of 200 megawatts, and 150 megawatts of it had been allocated, and therefore it represents 75%. So as you can still, none of those technologies that had been put out for tendering managed to get to even a 50% allocation stage. And it's mainly because of two reasons. Firstly, compliance issues. So a lot of the bidders had been in a rush. I think there had been some concern that we would have a party once, and then after that, that would be the end of this program. So there was a rush to try and get the 3,700 megawatts, and a lot of the rush resulted in bidders not being compliant, number one. But secondly, is that tactically, we had also decided that we definitely wanted to ensure that there would be a window 2 and a window 3 subsequent to this for competition purposes. Right? Maybe lastly, is that you would recall that whilst there was competition on price, there had been some indication already that the price caps in respect of the different technologies were like, you know, public. So for example, solar PV's price cap was 2.80 rand, and most of the bids that we received in the first window gravitated towards 2.80. So people would put bids in at 2.75 and 2.79, and that, I mean, it was more like, you know, this is the cap, and because we know that we're the only people that are ready, you know, this would it would be very difficult for anybody to beat that. And Chair, what's happened is now, and I'm digressing a little bit now, with hindsight, we're seeing a very nice pattern emerging out of the second window, which we closed in March, is that in the first window, when everybody migrated towards the price cap, in the second window, there's been a lot more competition on price, and the prices have fallen significantly, you know, which demonstrates that, in fact, one could still do this project on the basis of not price competition. Okay, so I'm not going to go into the detail around that. I did mention that the small projects, as you can see, that the allocation was 12.5 megawatts each for biomass and biogas, and then 25 for landfill gas and 75 for small hydro. There will still be another bite when we launch the small projects program very soon, in the next few weeks. Okay, so 2,127 megawatts has still been available for bidding in the next window or windows going forward, and we moved on those basis. Just for completeness sake, for those that are interested, these were the winning projects, the preferred bidders for solar PV. And I think at some point we also did some disaggregation on the provincial basis. Maybe just to summarize quickly is that most of the projects, Eastern Cape, Western Cape, Northern Cape, everybody else hit one or other renewable energy project except for KZN, Gauteng, and Mpumalanga. Those three provinces were the only ones that did not have any, if you like, preferred bidder allocated within their borders. Okay, this carries on, the 18 of them for PV, and then for wind, again, mainly Eastern Cape and the Western Cape. Eight bidders were preferred. And then for concentrating solar power, and two projects out of the 200, as I indicated, only two projects, both in the Northern Cape, were deemed successful. Okay, so I'm not going to go into any of that detail, but just to now take it forward around what the evaluation findings were. In other words, once we had done the evaluation and the adjudication and got ready, you know, to get a PFMA approval around that, we took the whole process through an independent legal review. In other words, an independent audit, just so that we are confident that, you know, we do not have any problems within the processes. And I'm not going to read it for you, but from a legal perspective, we're quite confident that in the list we had been very consistent, so there was no sense that there has been any bias. Bias and discretion tends to be the biggest problem that you suffer. From a technical perspective, you know, there had been some comfort, and then the, you know, the financial assessment were, I suppose, the biggest risk for error lay. There was comfort, and then lastly also in relation to governance, we got that audit opinion. If you go to slide number, I think it's upfront in terms of the teams, if I can take you. If I can take you to, I think it's slide, sorry, my slides are not numbered, oops. But it's the slide that shows the evaluation composition. You will see there on page 5 that the international review team comprised of those entities that are indicated there. So we're quite, I must say, we're quite confident in the kind of governance structure that have been put in place. But over and above that, the extent to which there has been compliance with the governance, not only from our own opinions sake, but also from an independent and that's the end of the presentation, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fane. Honourable members, apologies. Sometimes it happens. Halfway to the airport, I got a tire puncture. I was targeting the 6 o'clock flight. But anyway, Gary Bukhandadim noted at least to keep the fort. Now that is question time, you can kick off or followed by Honorable Smala. And who else? The two for now.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we need to congratulate DOE for following a process which, according to the presentation, we could see it had a lot of integrity, and one could not fault it for being open to abuse. My two questions relate to the technical evaluation team and to the on the environment. I just want to establish what was the role of the McDonald team. Were they supposed to do a due diligence on the correctness of the resource as stipulated by the bidder? For instance, if the bidder said this is the type of the strength of the resource that I'll be able to secure from that side, was that the role of the McDonald team to verify that type of data that has been supplied by the bidder? The second question on the environment, were you confident also that people had consulted the surrounding communities adequately around the erection or the building of some of these technologies, given the notion of people contesting that it should not be in my backyard? Are you satisfied that the consultation process with the community has been robust and adequate to the point that we will not be faced with litigations in future where people say, I don't want this thing in my backyard, and you put it there because we are, I should comment on that. That was a bit.
Honorable
Smaller.
Yes, Jay, thank you. Are you planning to have the same vigorous evaluation pertaining to Windows 2 and 3, and Was this from the beginning a cost a budgeted costed exercise for you as the department, and is it a budgeted costed exercise at Windows 2 and 3? Just for curiosity, you did receive 53 or you procure 53 bits, but 28 of those bits has got to start by June this year, 2012. Of the 2127 megawatts, are those processes on track? Will they meet those deadlines? And the remaining of the 3725 of those windows, are those also on track? On those, are you on your deadlines there? On the pertaining to the issues where you did not receive any bits, the landfills and the biomass. Are you planning to do a exercise where you're going to have those in Windows 2 or 3? Just want to see you there. On the issue concerning the 15,000 non-refundable deposits, why the clause, or why did you ask the bidders to sign a confidentiality clause or paper after that? I just would like to understand that. You made the discussion quite interesting when you touched on the price cap and the offtake agreement. How does that influence your second round when your price, when there's a clear indication that the pricing is changing? Can you influence the first round of negotiations over a 20-year period if there's such a big downscale on pricing? Because you didn't say exactly what the indications are, so I can't make a judgment to say it's down with 20% or 30%. But are you planning to go into negotiations in order to get a fair price or a value for us as a client? Or ESCOM or government, can you say that as a department that you are, that the process was totally transparent and fair? And the independent legal review, is it possible for us as a committee to actually see that and to read that actually report, or is that for your eyes only? And that's that. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, that is.
Just a few questions. What is the clarity? In your presentation, you said the minister determined in consultation with NERSA and in accordance with IRP 2010. 3,825 megawatts needed, minus the 100 megawatts which, as you said, ESCOM would provide. And then, as you went further later on, you referred to this 100 megawatts as small project. Now, what I'm not sure of is, if we talk small project and we talk ESCOM, are we not talking two different power producers? Because by small, I would imagine we're referring to power that is produced at maybe house level. Also, those kinds of projects which could not produce much power to can be put into the grid. Just clarity there as to how you intend going around or about with that kind of a project or those kinds of projects. The presentation also makes reference to only solar and wind bidders. two questions arise there. One is, the minute we talk solar, obviously we're talking also manufacturing of solar panels and the related parts. Are there plans towards looking at local manufacturing of such things that may be used in both in the wind and the solar production, like the part of the wind turbines? And if you have, what is the relationship between your initiatives and those of and those initiatives that might be taken by trade and industry around manufacturing? The third question is, as it relates to areas of, you refer to them as part A, B, and C. And in part B, you make reference to very important issues, matters of environment, matters of land and economic development, finance, technical, price and capacity. Quite obviously, there are a number of other role players there, including municipalities, farmers, including Department of Water and Environment, rural development, land. Where is land? Is it with rural development?
Rural development and
land reform. And land reform, yes. The economic development, finance, there are those departments also dealing. What would be the relationship in the process of unfolding these processes with those other stakeholders? Thanks for that.
In fact, Mr. Van, I also was going to ask that the department and SOEs were involved and their roles. So if you could just combine that. Let's just have a sense as to what each was doing, where, from the government side. Teremlot.
Just two questions that I forgot about, Chairperson. The first one, if you could refresh our memory, some of the things we dealt with some time ago, around, I know they were resolved, but I can't recall the details. The NERSA concerns when we had our hearing, there were concerns that were expressed by NERSA, and if you could explain to us how were they resolved, and incorporated within this process. The second one is when we conducted our oversight visit to CEF, we realized that CEF was encountering a problem where they could not play in the IPP space, because in most projects they were 51% owners of the project and therefore disqualified from taking part in the process. I can't recall the details. Could be the Darling Wind Farm and some other project somewhere, landfill project. I can't recall the details. But now, the question, using your own terminology, this might then be seen as standard investment. Now, how do we unlock value from this investment and ensure that they participate in the process in the future, but still stay scaling down on the state's involvement to be less than 51%? Because that's the point that CEF raised as a hurdle. That they would not be able to qualify for the IPP because they were participating with DBSA, I think, at one stage. But I'm not sure how the details are not that fresh in my mind, especially with the Darling Wind Farm. They were with DBSA, and it's possible that with other landfill projects they were involved with other state-owned enterprises.
Apologies, Honourable Reni.
No problem.
You just because it's so near.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I mean, it is heartening to see that we're starting to move forward on all of this. But I did want to unpackage a few of the issues, particularly with, we moved from a refit now to a kind of rebid program, which obviously we had a bit of a fight about last year. What I wanted to find out, though, was that in the refit program, essentially what the model we were working on was looking at a price that would generate a certain internal rate of return. which we felt was acceptable in terms of a generator and also acceptable in terms of what the country could afford to pay. So we didn't want to necessarily make somebody rich out of this program, but we wanted to give them a proper internal rate of return. I just wanted to see, when you looked at the financial models of these bids that came through, did you look at it with such an eye as well, in terms of what you felt was an acceptable internal rate of return? So even if people kept to a maximum price, you know, particularly in PV, where the price of the PV has come down considerably. So if somebody came in with an offer of 2.75, which is just less than 2.80, if the price has come down considerably, did you say, well, look, your internal rate of return here is far too large for us, and we think that this is unacceptable? I'd just be interested to see how you kind of made those decisions. The other point, though, when you said that in the second window the price has come down considerably, do you think that that's a product of more competition, so people had more of the necessary documentation in place, and so therefore they knew there was going to be more competition, so therefore they're putting more competitive prices? Or do you think that the cost of technology has, in fact, come down in that interim period such that people could put in a lower prices for that? Because I think that would also give us an indication going forward as to what we can expect from the IPP program or the renewable energy program. And then when I look at the biomass, biogas, landfill gas, and small hydro and see that no one submitted bids on that, do you think that that's a product of the fact that the maximum price is too low, and that people just didn't see it as a viable option at this point? I mean, and if that is the case, then surely we need to relook at this, because something like biogas is something that we have to exploit in some way. And if we are not given the right incentives in the market, then surely something needs to change from that. And I'd just be interested to hear your comment as to what you feel about that particular issue. And then just lastly, in terms of financing this program going forward, are we looking at SARI for this as well? I mean, we had a presentation on SARI last week, a short presentation, and it doesn't seem like there's been a lot of progress in that regard, but yet this renewable energy program is going forward at a pace. And surely this is a link-up here for SARI to also contribute something towards the financing of this, particularly the incremental cost of it. And what are we doing to do to make sure that that happens?
Okay, thank you, Chair. I will take them in the order that they came. The question about the technical evaluation and the role of Mott MacDonald. Firstly, the risk around the resource and the representations that the bidders make around the resource is theirs. What we do is to check that they have done some assessment, right? But it's just that. We're not there to make any judgment call as to whether we think that resource is adequate or whether it would materialize in the way that they have presented it to you. Because remember, when we do pay them, we pay them for what they have produced. So if they have misrepresented that resource, it's their risk. They just don't get paid and the project will fail. But secondly is that, remember, these are largely project finance deals, which means that a significant component of the money that goes in is debt by lenders. And lenders would be the very first who are going to ensure that the due diligence does interrogate the resource representations that are being made. So we do not play that. In fact, what Mott MacDonald or the technical team did for us was to ensure that, for example, our economic development criteria are aligned with the different technologies. Let me give an example. Right? Most of the, let's take wind for example, most of the big technology providers for wind are located in the US, in Western Europe, and then in China.
So the experiences out of Western Europe, for example, with their renewable energy program was that because Chinese product tends to be a lot more, shall we say, cheaper, there is some line in relation to when the cheapness is actually because of poor quality, right? And where is that line? So you need some technical awareness in order to interrogate the different technologies so that in your bid documents you're able to prescribe the standards. Remember, even though the risk is there, if the project fails, South Africa fails because it's opportunity cost, then we would have had, you know, wind turbines all over the country that do not run, and so it just creates a very bad image and so on. But also the fact that, you know, there might have been proper diligence around how we specify and settle on certain standards. You know, so that's the role that the technical team, we prescribe certain standards. Much as it's your risk, we still say that your equipment must meet the following requirements, you know, SABS or equivalent standards. And, you know, there's been a lot of lobbying, I must indicate, you know, for DTI, even the different, you know, political principles for certain products to be allowed to participate. And that's why we had that. Regarding the consultation with communities and that, again, it's a very similar thing, that the environmental laws provide a process, or provide for a process to be followed pursuant to an authorization. And very key in that process is the public consultation process, where you have to demonstrate that you have consulted the affected party, the so-called interested affected party. And you do that in a transparent manner. In other words, you're required to put on a website, to advertise in the newspapers and so on, even the list of the people who attended, the agenda, and the discussions that took place at that. So you don't have that, you know, if a proper environmental assessment process is followed, you would have to consult those communities around that. It's interesting, though, that you link this to the so-called NIMBY issue, the Not In My Backyard story, because, in fact, it's one of the other problems that South Africa has to look at strategically, because sometimes objections are not for reasons relating to, you know, the merits of the project. They're mainly because everybody wants it out there. They don't want it within their own backyard. Then the question around whether we're planning to use the same evaluation approach for Windows 2 and 3 is that, incidentally, we are evaluating Windows 2 right now. And from Windows 1, we did a post-mortem and there were certain gaps. Maybe just to link it with another question that was asked down the line is that what happened is that we had 58 bids received and only 20, okay, whatever the number, 53, I can't remember anymore now. 53, 28 pre-qualified. All those that did not pre-qualify were called into different bilateral meetings, so where we explained what those problems were that led to them being non-compliant and so on, so that they can then correct those and then hopefully submit bids in subsequent windows. But during that process, they also raised certain issues that had led to us adjusting, you know, our documentation in line with the bid rules, you know, in order to improve it. So it was lessons both ways in terms of how we would adjudicate or evaluate going forward. The budget cost, the two dimensions here, I don't know which budget you're talking about here, unfortunately, but just to give you some sense, there is a budget in relation to the billions of rands that you're going to have to pay because of those contracts, right? So over the next, shall we say, over the MYPD, right? I'm sure you're familiar with that. Over the tariff determination process, the multi-year tariff determination process, already a certain provision had been made in the Remember, we had a 25% tariff increase. Within the 25% allocation or allocations, some provision had already been made for this program. Right? So that budget, if you like, is there. But it's a very, if you like, favorable position right now because, as you rightfully indicated, only in June will we reach financial close for Window 1 projects, and therefore they are unlikely to spend that allocation that had been made for them in the current cycle of tariff determination. So there would be, if you like, a reserve that is available. So that is not the worry. We have other worries, but this is not the subject of the discussion today. So that budget is there. Secondly, the procurement budget, if that is what you're worried about. In other words, to pay all of these expensive transaction advisors, etc. We did not have that. You're very familiar with our budget situation. But we managed to find a mechanism around it. And the mechanism is a very simple one. It's based on the fact that each and every one of these bidders, and I think I want to link this with the 15,000, you know, people make a lot of issues out of the 15,000. The requirement in the bidding is that there is a development fee that each of the bidders have to pay. But that development fee is in order to cater for the cost of the transaction. Each transaction costs scores of millions, right? And the department doesn't have the money. So the bidders pay for them, right? So they're going to, once they reach financial close, they would put that development fee into what we call the project development fund administered by National Treasury. Then we're able to, you know, make this whole program sustain itself. We're not going to look, you know, to the fiscals for, you know, for additional funding in respect of that. It's a fraction of the actual transaction cost, sorry, of the actual project cost. Each project, I mean, if you think about a 100 megawatt kind of project, it's probably 2, 3 billion rand. So the fee that they would have to contribute towards the transaction is a minute fraction of them. And I hope it answers the question if I understood it correctly. Then the issue about financial close, yes. The losers, as I indicated, they, you know, we have absolutely no obligation towards them except to explain what those things are, which have led to them failing to meet the requirement. They have been explained. A lot of them submitted in window 2 and so on. So it's an open, you know, a process for them because they had already pre-qualified in the first window. What happens to the landfill, gas, and those other small projects? Two quick issues. Firstly, is that we recognize that there would have been a separate program for the small. You won't get a 100 megawatt landfill gas program in this country. They tend to be 3 megawatts, 5 megawatts, and so on. And the same with small hydro. That's why we call it small. And the same with you know, these other ones. So a specific program had been designed for that, and the market had also been aware that there is a specific program that is coming for those, and that's why there was no responses, number one. But secondly is that, yes, as already pointed out rightfully, with that, if you like, refit and bidding confusion at the beginning, and the publication of price caps, there had been a sense that the cap that had been indicated, particularly for landfill, was not viable. And we had dealt with it in a particular way by saying that, don't worry, because in any event, we're going to have a specific program for landfill and those other projects. So it doesn't worry us that there were no bids there. And then maybe lastly is that, out of this, and just in case somebody wants to ask the question, is that, you might recall that there would have been a specific renewable energy / cogeneration program out of sugar, out of paper, and those kind of, if you like, renewable biomass programs. And the concern there was that if you look at the allocation, 12 megawatts and so on, was not enough. And that had also been dealt with by indicating that there would be a specific determination and a program specifically. Deal with that. Honorable Smale is not here to listen to this one about the confidentiality. This question has come up lots and lots of times before, very controversial. And, you know, if you really think about it, you know, I think we have demonstrated just how prudent we want to be in this process. It's as simple as this. This is a rolling program. There is a lot of sensitivities around the commercial information that gets submitted. Now you can imagine that people don't make window one, and the window one documentation is out there in the public. Anybody can get access to those to that documentation and use it to their advantage. Right? How do you protect that? You protect that by insisting that we make certain representations around how we keep the documentation, right? Who has access to it, etc., etc. But equally, on the other side, you have to do exactly the same thing. Sketch a scenario. In window one, we were also aware, not through any mechanism, but the fact of how many environmental authorizations had been issued. So you could literally tell how many projects were out there that would qualify, right? Now, how do we stop collusion? Particularly when there is this push by the different, and I'm going to say it, by the different industry associations that we want to have a feed-in tariff around feeding, right? So how do we stop the three or four projects that have got to that stage of colluding? We have to make sure that they sign certain representations that say that they will not do the following things. And that's where this whole thing, you know, comes from. But having said that, it is not, you know, it is not confidential in a manner that does not allow an auditor to come and check, you know, and verify that all of those elements that would have been, you know, hidden in the confidentiality are not taken care of. And by the way, when we presented this to the market, the question was raised, hands up those that would want to, in the context of the explanation that we had given, they would want us to not have any confidentiality around all of those things. And in fact, they had said to us, that's precisely one of the reasons that they do not want to submit the information to ESCOM, because they see that as being, you know, their competitor and so on. So please, let's have that common understanding around where it comes from, this confidentiality issue. And then, Chair, the issue around the price cap, on the second the window, and I did touch on this. It did influence the second window very positively, I must say, because in the second window, and I know this is not what the presentation is about today, in the second window we did not pay any particular attention, we did not make any reference to a price cap. And as a result, there was this sense that there were more projects available. There were only 2,200 megawatts or 2,400 megawatts left in this bidding round, and therefore it did influence the extent to which people, you know, reduced their price. If I can maybe link this question with the one that was raised last by Honorable Raylan, is that the problem with the refit versus the rebid debate is that we have to recognize that we have a very dynamic price situation out there. Right? So depending on what happens in the Chinese and American and Western European markets, the different prices of the technology, you know, would rise or would fall. At some point, it was flattening out, and then you go to a point where it started to fall drastically, particularly around the time that we're starting to procure. Now, one obviously has to take a view as to what your capital costs at that point in time, at that point of bidding, are going to be. Right? So, one can represent, to answer the question, one can represent an internal rate of return of 20%, because the capital costs that you are presenting are relevant at that point. It's almost like the petrol price. You know, at that point, yes, the return is there. But the risk is that as a country, instances, we did an assessment just before we launched, that some projects were showing returns of 50%. I don't know of any industry in the world, any legitimate industry that would make, you know, returns up to that level. And that's where the problem was. Like, even when we asked for them to bid, there was no dramatic decline in their rates of return. We're still seeing very attractive rates of return, even at price levels that are significantly less than what the ceiling caps or the, what the price caps were that we had prescribed. Because this thing is moving as well. So, I mean, what is the best way of testing that? You test that by introducing competition. So let the guy, let them take the risk. Let them go and find the best prices and then come back and tell us that they can make it work on this basis. We must not be, we are not best positioned to determine what the market prices are. We're not. And that's the whole point about having competition or having a tender, by the way. Then the question around whether the process was transparent and fair. Well, as a requirement, the PFMA and the Constitution require us to do that, and the best way of dealing with that is by way of external review, but also by checking with the people that participated in the process. Incidentally, maybe we need to mention that, is that we also have a knowledge management functionality that has been packaged into this program. And by that we mean a function for which somebody gets paid that, you know, assesses the market sentiments out there. So government departments, bidders, the regulator, ourselves, banks, and so on. Right? The surveys, constant surveys to say, what did you think, how did you find the process, and so on and so forth. And we believe that it is also independent because we do not pay for it. It's paid for by a donor. We just make sure that it happened. And I suppose one can place some reliance on the outcome of that process to assess whether, you know, some of these questions are just being misrepresented by us. But we're quite confident that if you go test out there, there is a very good basis for you to get an independent opinion around the process. The independent legal review, and can the committee see that? I think it actually should be, you know, made available to the committee so that the committee can, you know, vouch for this that we are saying. So it's as simple as yes. And then the issue around the hundreds and the hundreds, and I apologize for confusing you because, yeah, it was confusing. In fact, Chair, with your permission, I can also confirm that it confused the regulator. At that point when the determination was being made, there was this question about the missing 100 megawatts because they did not understand where it came from. There are two different hundreds of megawatts. Eskom is doing a 100 megawatt renewable energy program. Right? One of them was committed before, the other one is being done out of this. So if you look at the integrated resource plan, it's just in the way that the determination was made. Remember, the law required that the minister determined and it in the independent referendum. So the window that the minister determined was from 2011, from 2010 up to 2016. And within that window is 3,000, if you look at the IRP, it's 3,800 megawatts, but it also includes 100 megawatts of ESCOM. So you have to exclude that which belongs to ESCOM in the first instance. Right? So take the ESCOM renewable energy program out because this is not a this is not an IPP. Secondly, is that whatever is left, we had then determined or decided that we needed to have, in fact, this committee had been asking those questions about distributed generation, about rural development, and so on. Right? That one of the biggest criticism of the IPN will come to that point is that it tends to be large. As we indicated, these projects come in billions of rand. You know, there are no small projects that one can put, you know, within a cooperative in a rural area that is based on biomass, that is based on and so forth. So we had deliberately introduced a small projects program. So less than 5 megawatts. It just happens that the numbers, you know, tend to be 100. So we could have said the 200 megawatt, you know, small projects program and the 100 megawatt ESCOM program. That would have not been confused. But actually, the 100 is 100 for small and another 100 for ESCOM, and that's why the confusion. I apologize around that. Then the issue around the manufacturing of components and what initiatives by DTI and others and so on, and also to link that with the other government departments, is that maybe let's start with the government departments that have been involved in here, is that this program is an intergovernmental program. So in other words, we report to the cluster, there is a DG cluster, the infrastructure cluster, to which we present the program. In fact, the decision to fast track this and to resolve the problem is then around the refit and rebuild, had been a very sensitive, not a sensitive, but a very critical matter at that cluster. And on that cluster, ourselves, the Department of Trade and Industry, the Department of Environment and Water, National Treasury, Economic Development, and then Transport, Agriculture, and Agriculture. Yeah, that department, yeah. They all participate there. And even where some departments do not necessarily sit on that cluster, because some of the departments sit on other clusters, what happens is that you still have the laws. For example, when it comes to land use, etc., etc., suddenly the Department of Local Government comes in, because they are an interested department as to how the municipalities go around with the process. And I omitted to mention, for example, well, needless to say, the Department of Public Enterprise, mainly because in the main, ESCOM will be the off-taker, but over and above that is that you have a situation where connecting into the grid, you know, either via ESCOM or via the municipal electricity distributor, present itself with, you know, different sets of challenges, and there would be work group upon work group and so on around how to resolve those issues. So, Chair, I mean, definitely we can vouch that this is a very, you know, comprehensive intergovernmental process involving it. And then there's the regulator as well, not necessarily as part of the working group, but as an independent, you know, player against which we have to test certain things. And that leads me to the question around how we have dealt with the NERSA concerns, and I'm glad that we have dealt with this issue as well. Let's just go back. NERSA issues related to the fact that in terms of, well, they're two-sided. Firstly, in terms of the Electricity Regulation Act as it stands, one has to follow a particular process around licensing, right? And that process is prescribed, I think, in 12, 13, 14, and 15 sections of the Electricity Regulation Act. And then in Section 34, which is when the minister makes determinations and all of that. And what is also very clear in Section 18 is that NERSA cannot predetermine tariffs without flouting the provisions of the law. So NERSA cannot wake up and say the tariff must be this than the other, right? Because the law says there must be somebody who proposes. NERSA opens it up for public consultation. NERSA considers objections from the public, and only once that has happened can NERSA say the tariff must therefore be there. So if you predetermine, you would have not followed that particular process. That had been the big issue. So we were left with two options. The one was to either change the law, which would have taken much longer than what we could afford, or find a way around it. And the way that we found around it was to follow the process, which was that in terms of Section 34, this is what would happen, and there would be a process in terms of which, you know, tariffs,
payments through competition, which is, you know, compliant with the law. And then once that has been done through a Section 34 and a concurrence by NERSA, then NERSA, the regulation says NERSA is then bound by that. And that's how you would avoid the uncertainty around licensing and so on. So the issue with NERSA has been resolved to the extent that they then concur. They issued a concurrence to say, yes, we're happy that it can be dealt with. What has still not been dealt with, and it's a matter that will come out when the regulation amendment bill comes through, is whether we now change the law in order to facilitate that the regulator can predetermine that. Right? So in other words, whether South Africa can introduce a tariff. We have our own views, but we're finding this a little bit urgent as well, because just to digress a little bit with your permission, Chair, on the demand side, there is a need to predetermine a tariff. There is a need to provide an incentive for those that would take, you know, or that would achieve certain energy savings. And that's why we're looking at this thing in that light. But yes, the short answer is that has been done. Then the other interesting question around the unlocking of, if you like, the stranded value relating to SOCs like SF and so on. Just to recap, when we indicated that this program represents some 50 billion rands worth of investment, this is not money out of the state coffers. This is foreign direct investment and other people's money, if you like, right, that they're putting into the economy. That's how this contributes towards economic growth. If we were to say to a state-owned entity like SEF that they must invest 50 billion rand in renewable energy, the question is, where do they find the money from? I think that's the big difference here. Right. So the reason that we have said SOCs cannot play as IPPs in this game. It's precisely for that reason. Because you take from one hand and you give to the other hand. It's still the same state. You know, the state owns these entities 100%, so who's bluffing who here? Whereas in the other scenario, you're saying this is somebody else that brings in their money. You want them to bring in their money, take the risk, and then, you know, you would leverage in that sense, right? But having said that, the provisions are not that the state-owned enterprises cannot play. The provisions are that they cannot be IPPs. In fact, of these preferred bidders, it's just that we don't have the detail here, but the IDC, as an example, is an equity player, is a co-developer in 14 of these projects. Right? So the state has taken a position in relation to that. The state has not taken a majority risk position in that difference. So that's the one part of the question that we have. We are very resolute in that position around the 51% and the IPP definition and all of that. But perhaps the second part is what we need to address, and that is how do we then unlock that? And one of the ways that we need to do is to perhaps deal with this is to, you know, encourage them to seek partnerships with the other private sector investors in order to co-develop these projects. And in fact, in that regard, I'm also aware that a number of these projects do have other than financial investors like the ITC and the GBSA in them. And SEF is one of those that is taking a position. I don't think it would have been as easy for ESCOM, mainly because ESCOM is the buyer. So ESCOM is on the other side. ESCOM is the counterpart. You know, ESCOM buys all of this. So I don't think ESCOM could buy and then also sell, you know, at the same time. But yeah, we're also very cognizant of the need to unlock that, if you like, that potential, because in fact, government's own program is around those kind of arrangements, private
certain SOCs want to take, you know, certain positions and purport that, you know, that it makes sense from a governance perspective. I have dealt with the question around the regulation of the IRR and what has been the experience and so on. But basically, it's changing all the time, and you will see when we present the outcomes for Window 2, and when we compare Window 2 and Window 1, you will see just what has happened to all of those financial parameters, the IRR, the capital cost, and what the tariff offering is in relation to that. But I can confirm at this point, Chair, that it is very, it's a very positive decline that we're seeing in the tariff that has been offered. And having said that, I must also indicate that the players that we are seeing are not the kind of players. You know, there's been some concern that if it's price competition, that people are just going to bid on price and they would not be able to follow through the life cycle. So, but the players that we're seeing are big, reputable companies that, you know, we're confident that they would be able to make the whole process as well. And maybe that question around June and so on, I did not complete the question. Answering the question is that the prognosis is that of the 28 projects that have been shortlisted, I think about 3 or 4 of them have one or other kind of problem that perhaps indicates that they might not make financial close by June. But as for the rest of them, indication is that they will be coming into the market from about the end of May and the end of June. In fact, and I don't know if I should be mentioning this for this committee, but just so that you have a sense, is that the concern that we have is another kind of concern. It's in relation to the lumpiness of this investment and its impact on the rent. So basically what's going to happen is we're going to have everybody closing May, June, and then suddenly you have lots of, you know, euros and whatever being swapped for rent, and then the impact on the rent, you know, might be that you will, yeah. So it's a smaller kind of problem, but we thought that we should just let you know. And this is just to build the confidence around the fact that we know that it is coming, and we're trying to find mechanisms of making sure that, you know, it does not turn on
What happens to the 3 and 4 if they don't make the deadline?
Then, Chair, what happens if they do not make the deadline? Essentially, those megawatts go into the next window, it's as simple as that. And unfortunately, we follow the processes and the rules of procurement. And the rules are that you would have issued a bid bond, 100,000 rand per megawatt. When you were appointed as a preferred bidder, you would have had doubled that to 200,000 rand per megawatt. And the risk of reaching financial close is yours. So if you can't reach financial close, we have the right to cash in your bid bond. So if it's a 100 megawatt project, then we're entitled to take 20 million rand out of your pocket. Unfortunately, those are the rules. You know, so we're watching it closely, and yeah, Chair, that's the sense that we're getting from. Obviously, you know, you get to hear through the market. You get, you know, it's not like you sit down with them and they tell you this, that, and the other. And hopefully, they would have dealt with some of those challenges. That they, it's unfortunately the nature of the of such a process. The rules are the rules, Chair. I think the question around landfill has been covered. Yeah, maybe just to close the loop here, the intention is that straight after the evaluation, so the evaluation task, straight after we announce the preferred bidders for Window 2, we will launch the small projects, the 100 megawatt program and so on. Then the last question was, how we can factor SARI into all of this to
one needs to, you know, get a better understanding of the incremental cost and its drivers and so on. And there are two big drivers for it. One is the actual cost in relation to the technology. But secondly is the actual cost of the financing around it. And yes, Sari, and I'm sure that you had a presentation recently. Sari's philosophy is to cushion the costs relating to the financing of these programs through the provision of, if you like, concessionary loans into the program. Now, where we add is, well, first of all, is that yes, it is very welcome, and we're trying to find mechanisms to do that. What we're looking at is to create a renewable energy fund. And last year, I think, no, it was early this year, could be wrong, maybe last year, we issued a request for proposals around this fund, because once you have this fund, you could have a requirement or as a precondition for participating that this fund would have to participate in that program, because it would make available much, much cheaper debt than what is available at the moment. Right? At the moment, it's mainly, you know, foreign companies bringing equity, but the debt is unfortunately largely South African debt, right? For a number of reasons. I mean, Forex, there is foreign currency indexation in some of the bids, which means that they would have to hedge and so on. Right? So when you bring foreign money into the country, we don't dollarize the South African economy, so they hedge and it creates additional costs. So we've got all manner of problems around how one can deal with that incremental cost. Not necessarily relating to this specific project itself, but also relating to South Africa wanting to bring hundreds of billions of rand into the country at a competitive level, you know, from a rand perspective, as opposed to, you know, what the equivalent cost would have been had we brought the investment in as dollars or euro or yen or something else. So it's something that's receiving attention. And just to conclude, once we have that better assessment of how this could work, we would be able to then formally incorporate the SARI concept into these different procurement windows that we'll be running. Yeah, I think that's the last of the questions, sir. Thank you.
I didn't leave any. Thank you very much, Mr. Pane. Honourable members, I'm sure it's time for a break in the left stretch. Let's take a 10-minute break.
Thank you. it home. That is home to everything. You won't be calling it refugee.
Now.
Mr. Fane, a few from my side. That's out of interest, maybe just to have a sense. How many, if you can answer this one, how many four-roomed RTB houses can 100 megawatts power? So that we can have a sense how big or how small is that. Around the beaters, I thought you would share this bit with us with the investors conference that took place last year, and I was invited, but apologies once again, came at a bad time. If you could just share with us the highlights of that investors conference in Midrand, Kalaka Estate. And linked to that is in the 53, just your sense, or even more accurate if you can, the percentage of international bidders. And on hindsight, you know, I was going to ask questions, which concerns were genuine and which concerns were imagined before the meeting, because a lot came out in the press of quietly. Of course, the Honorable Mlodo did ask, you know, the genuine side. But just to remind us, there were lots of concerns that were raised, you know, along the way, some imagined. But I'm raising it as the extent to which the process itself was able to either dispel or appropriately address those concerns. We had 353 bidders and 28 qualified. But now, what would have been the ideal total power if ideally all the 53 bidders had won? What amount of power would we be getting from them? The licensing process by NERSA, I know NERSA is not around. We invited them, but because the licensing process is not complete, if you could just, in a very, very brief, indicate how does it fit in the process now that it's the last week of May, I'm sorry, last week of April, and the successful bidders have got to start doing their implementation by June. Although this can you hear a little bit around monitoring, evaluation, and review mechanism? And the monitor, how, what kind of mechanism is there to monitor the implementation? Because, as I say, there's a lot of quite stringent rules for implementation, and it's human nature for people to cut corners. I'm sure in anticipation you may have worked out a mechanism. Can you share that with us? Just as a comment, lest I forget, these small projects, you know, on biogas, and just as a comment, we will be keen on that. We'll monitor it because it's a very interesting area. I was actually going to ask myself, why zero in all of those? Particularly that in January we went to Marianne Hill Landfill Gas Project, and it's a project that has been going on for some time. Is my assumption a little bit stretched that would have attracted other landfill gas initiatives, especially also those that included or involved SEF. Not that SEF would have been there. That's just that assumption. Local manufacturing. This committee started running energy public meetings last year. The 1st of November was on job prospects of job creation in local manufacturing in the renewable energy. And there was a lot of pro and anti positions on that. Some are saying that the current bidding or the current offer is not enough for local investment. And the Department of Energy, Department of Trade and Industry, and Department of Economic Development were steadfast that they've created adequate framework and environment for that investment. Now, I don't expect you to repeat, but maybe you can comment that after Windows 1, has that really confirmed the department's position? Because I don't say the department's position, it's already been presented, but it has to sense whether this first window has really given some signal that we're on track on that. Surely you'd appreciate that we're very keen, you know, whether within energy or even as public representatives, on local manufacturing. I think that's all. Oh, sorry. Just a few. At this stage in time, have you been able to have a sense of how many jobs will be created? I'm aware that there's a variance, you know, at construction stage. The jobs, if I'm correct, go right up construction and installations, whereas thereafter, for maintenance and operations, that changes. But if just one could have a sense. You said there were no bidders, successful bidders from Gauteng, Mpumalanga, and KZN. Now, particularly Gauteng, I mean, one would have assumed that the hub of this country's economy, where there's a lot of investment, there could have been people who were able to successfully bid. Was there anything that could have come, or they could have missed as Gauteng investors, even international investors mostly located in that area? Thank you very much for now.
Thanks, Chair. Just to respond, starting with the question around the number of four-roomed houses. One can do a quick calculation based on 2 kilowatts per household. 2 kilowatts is sufficient to provide power to a three-bedroom house. So the number ranges from a 100 megawatt plant like that can supply 50,000 houses, right? Or alternatively, 100,000 RTP houses. So 100,000 RTP houses or 50,000 three-bedroom houses. That's for 100 megawatt, yeah. Or alternatively, 1 megawatt, a megawatt is 1,000 kilowatts,
1 megawatt can supply 1,000 RTP houses or 500 three-bedroom houses.
So you just divide it by two.
Then, Chair, the question around the the BIDAS conference and the, just some of the highlights. When we held the BIDAS conference, we had a draft procurement document that had already been put in place. And as I had indicated, it had been consulted with ESCOM, it had been consulted with the regulator, it had been consulted with the lender. And BIDAS were then given the opportunity to clarify some of the issues that might have been a little bit unclear at that point. Chair, you asked for highlights. I think the attendance was overwhelming. There was very keen interest. We definitely got the sense that South Africa was a very keen investment destination for investors in that space. If I can perhaps link this with the question that was asked, what percentage of these investors are international? An overwhelming number of them, when I say overwhelming, it's more than 90% of the investors are overseas based, and that's precisely because the program is designed like that. It's about drawing foreign direct investment in the country. I think in the main also it's because what we also find, South African players tend to partner. Remember I mentioned the issue about 40% South African participation. Their contribution in the main is in respect of land. So South African investors bring land to the deal most of the time. They bring the local knowledge, etc., but they don't necessarily bring the equity. Right? So you find very few South African entities that bring the equivalent amount of equity that the internationals bring in, which actually demonstrates that this is successful in the way that it brings fresh capital into the system, as opposed to just trying to harness funding that is available. So I would say more than 90% of those investors are foreign. But having said that, Chair, just to reiterate, let's not misunderstand it. Each and every one of those consortia has, by design, 40% South African participation, even though that the lead would be a foreign entity. 100% of all the technologies that we see in the program are foreign-based. And I suppose that's where the challenge is, that how do you localize those technologies and consequently create the jobs. Right? So at the BIDAS conference, some of the issues that had come up, for example, was how the design of the program, remember at that point it was not clear how it was going to unfold for the small programs, and there was a sense that firstly, if you ask bidders to put 15,000 rand, what is it for, and why is it maybe not keeping the small players out, and then secondly the 100,000 and the 200,000 per megawatt bid and preferred bidder bonds respectively could also be big barriers. And we answered that by making that commitment that there would be a small program, right? And by the way, when we say small program, 5 megawatts is more than 100 million rands worth of investment, right? So we call it small in relative terms. And in that program,
excuse me, come again. 5 megawatts is how much?
5 megawatts is more than 100 million rands worth of project. So then it's already.
relative. We call it small because it's not 1 billion rands, but it's not like small because it's 20 million rands. It's more than 100 million rands, and we call it small in that context. that we would, we indicated that we would relax the 15,000 requirement to access the documentation. The documentation would be a lot simpler, the PPA would be a lot simpler, and we would also relax the bid bond and the preferred bidder bond, just so that we make it possible for the small players to participate. And in fact, our sense is that apart from the imported technology, most of the small projects would be local entities. And obviously, depending on the extent of the success of the program relative to objectives that would have been set, that we can increase the thing. That 100 megawatts is just arbitrary, it's a starting point. We could easily make it 100 megawatts now and then 100 megawatts next year and so on and so forth, and have, you know, lots of small projects all over the country, you know, depending on its success. Some of the other issues raised at the bidders conference, and I think we need to level before somebody raises the issue, is that you would have noticed that in the first window there is heavy heavy reliance on A, external transaction advisors. When I say external transaction advisors, is that they're international, right? The one. And then secondly is that most of that capacity, right? I'm saying most, and I'll qualify why most, is sitting outside of government. So in other words, it's not within the Department of Energy. It's not within, you know, government itself. And that had been an issue that we need to find a way in terms of which we localize that. And in fact, in Windows 2 and 3, there are deliberate interventions to deal with that particular issue, because we've got experience now. We think that we can win ourselves of dependence, of 100% dependence on the national advice. But I think it was also very important in the first window because of the reason that I mentioned earlier on, that who are we dealing with as the investors? We're dealing with international investors, and international investors take comfort in the fact that, in fact, the people who have, you know, advised and have put the documentation together or assisted in making sure that the documentation stands the scrutiny are largely international investors. Obviously, they are directed by ourselves. We tell them what we want. But in terms of making sure that it happens quickly, I think that's the big issue, that it happens very quickly with very short turnaround times, you know, has been something that we think the next challenge is for us to be able to do that. And then lastly, to build the capacity within the department, and there has been a concerted effort to do that. We have started a unit within the department to deal specifically with the IPP program. It's called the IPP unit. And therein, the experts will be housed so that the department can be able to undertake this program more and more on its own. But obviously, having indicated that there's a classical problem around drawing people into the public service, so we must never undermine that. It's a struggle to bring that kind of expertise into the department because people prefer to work in the private sector for one simple reason, that the private sector will pay five times what the equivalent government lawyer will get paid, you know, if not 10 times or 100 times, I don't know. So with some, you know, level of effort, we believe that we can still build some capacity, not necessarily to the same extent. We'll still get external expertise, but we will also bring that in. I think those were some of the issues. So I've covered the question also around the international bidders. And how much power would all of these guys had produced had they won? I can't remember the number, but it was close to 5,000 megawatts that they all won. And had they all, you know, been successful in getting the contract at that point. In the second window, I think it's about 6,000 megawatts of bids. So you always want to have more bids than what you are prepared to take, because that's what drives the price.
fairly attractive bidding program, notwithstanding the fact that we've indicated there's only 3,000 megawatts. We received a whole lot more. We'd have been more worried if there were 3,000 megawatts and we received only 1,000 megawatts. Incidentally, we were anticipating that we would receive less megawatts than what was in the determination. And that's why we designed windows 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. The original plan was that if we don't get enough in window 1, we'll get it in window 2, then in window 3, and so on. But on in round in window 1, we had everything that we could afford. And it was just our choice to not take all of it for reasons relating to competition and so forth. So, I suppose the big question is, has this process dispelled those concerns around the recent tender? And Chair, we deliberately did not reflect on this now because we think it's too early, but there are patterns emerging out of window 2 that confirm that this was the right approach to have followed. There is an issue that I omitted to mention earlier on regarding the guys who do not qualify. So we call them in and we show them what the problems are that led to them not complying. But what also needs to be indicated is that those that have been indicated to be successful or preferred bidders, and we are not satisfied with what you call value for money, right? It's in the PFMA, in the Treasury regulation, is that we call them in as well. We give an example. You establish a certain pattern, right? There is a norm. So you receive 28 bids, and you can see that for PV, the price tends to gravitate towards a certain level, and the economic development criteria gravitates towards a certain norm, right? And then you get the outlier. Right? So you get a guy who is saying, I will do this for 280, but he's giving 50% less jobs than the other guy who's doing exactly the same. And although when you look at the resource level, you look at the financing cost, etc., etc., they are all the same. So the bid rules are such that we have the right to go back to them and say, yes, you are preferred bidder, but here are the conditions. You go and lower your price or you increase your economic development. So that process is something that I forgot to indicate. It does not just apply to those. It's not like, oh, I made it and then that's it. You know, the law requires us to do that in terms of this so-called value for money. And I think that just confirms that because you have that ability in this program, which you do not have in a refit, we would have been in a situation where under the refit, you would have had guys coming in at 280 and producing X number of jobs, and you would have absolutely no say as to whether they've represented value for money, because the nature of the refit is that, you know, there's no competition in relation to that. You know, it's first come, first serve. And so this thing goes forward. So we want to come back at some point and just show you, you know, on a comparative basis, you know, the pros of having gone this way relative to the refit program and vice versa. Incidentally, one of the other issues that we had raised at that point about the refit is that we had two examples, well, three, maybe four. We had the Spanish experience, we had the Czech experience, and we also had the Italian experience at that point. Since then, the UK itself had a feed-in tariff program, and they have reneged on it. Right? In other words, they have said, much as we have asked you to put in projects and we'll pay you so much, sorry, we cannot afford this. You know, it's very well if you are a first world OECD country, but South Africa cannot afford that. Because the first thing that happens is that people say, ah, look at them, you know, and very bad investment, regulatory uncertainty, and so on. And I think that's one of the other issues that, you know, one is able to manage through this program rather than through a refit. And that we when we do contract, we contract, you know, on a good faith basis. There is absolutely no element of the contracting that is unknown. We have the money, we have the legal wherewithal, and there is a 20-year commitment to do that. It's not like down the line we're going to say, oh, sorry, you know, can't afford because we haven't got the number of jobs and so on. In fact, we take it further and we force them to commit to build technologies locally so that we can create the job. Licensing, I'm going to try and hurry up a little bit now. Licensing.
Just before that, your emphasis is the fact that foreign investors in particular have studied, analyzed, and were relatively satisfied with the regulatory environment because it created certainty. Thank you.
Definitely, Chair. I think that's the issue. Whereas the other side of it is that when you say refit, right, one of the biggest issues was that, okay, you have refit, how many megawatts do you provide? Right? Now, you cannot build an industry on 3,000 megawatts. So you have to make representations beyond the 3,000 megawatts. So you have to say, the refit program that runs every year up to, say, 10,000 megawatts, but we don't know what the tariff is, right? Now, you know the debates around the price part of electricity going into the future. That's not settled yet. So how can you make representations around so many megawatts at a certain tariff level when you don't have, when you don't have any certainty around that? So you would have had all manner of, you know, uncertainties creeping in that, you know, do not allow you to do that. I think, having said that, if we do the price part and it is a, if you like, a social compact that everybody buys into, that this is what the price of electricity is going to do going into the future, then one can work backwards. But at that point, there was absolutely no way we could have been able to do that because we would have different things in different time, you know, places. This one must follow, yet it's unsettled. Sorry, this one must come first, yet it's unsettled, and therefore you couldn't do enough step numbers. You can't start with step number 10 when step number 2 is not yet settled and so on. And so, Chair, certainty is a very big issue, and I believe I speak, you know, with the mission as well, because it's an issue that we discussed at the cluster also, is that there are parallels with other segments in the economy where you need to have certainty so that one can then draw the investment into it. Because if you get that wrong, then it becomes a very clumsy dogfight. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So, Chair, to move on, the licensing. NERSA has accordingly held licensing hearings in all these provinces where the projects are located. That has been completed, and the sense is that there is no problem whatsoever in relation to licensing. And there's also the Section 34 determination, so NERSA is bound, but you know they've also gone out and followed their processes in terms of what is required for licensing. So the idea is that when the guys are ready to close the deals, I'm talking financial close. Remember the story that I mentioned around, you know, what happens with the Reserve Bank and all of that. Like when they're here, then the licenses will be issued. In fact, draft licenses have already been circulated for comment and so on. Chair, you raised a very important question around the monitoring mechanism for implementation. And in fact, I would even go further and say that if one has to build any capacity within government, it's the capacity to do exactly that. Right? So forget about getting transaction advisory services and trying to bring it into the department. You know, that's not where we should be focusing. What we should be focusing on is to make sure that when we have 20-year contracts, we are able to monitor them, you know, effectively. The life cycle contract management capacity, the IPP unit addresses that, right? Where each and every one of those projects, once the implementation agreement has been signed, you would have a dedicated resource that knows this thing backwards, and the minute there is breach around any of those provisions, one is able to take corrective measures and so on within government. There are parallels with the triple P unit in National Treasury, for example, where they have signed contracts around schooling, around government accommodation, around Caltrain, etc., and they have dedicated resources to deal with that. And we are addressing it in that way. Now, the mechanism obviously is in the same way that you do the assessment. The mechanism is multidisciplinary, so it's like a legal capacity, legal slash contracting capacity, technical, it's also financial, so that one is able to deal with that. But you're also leveraging other capacity. Remember, the Department of Environment has the capacity to monitor the authorizations that are issued, you know, the green scorpions and so on and so forth. So you would leverage those in order to make sure that we kept the bidders honest relative to what they have committed to do. I'm not going to repeat the questions around landfill, the problems around that, but to also indicate, Chair, that in fact, a number of landfill projects were pre-qualified in the first window, right? And they were pre-qualified against a certain price cap, and we did indicate that there would have been problems with the price cap, and they proved to us that in fact there were those problems and so on. But what we also found around landfill gas was that, you know, if you follow that same process, let's take an example, and we can give a live case with SEF. That was the question that was also asked. A less than 20 megawatt project, right? Let's call it 13 megawatts. 13 megawatt project requires 15,000 renters to access the big document. Requires 200,000 megawatts to get you. No, 100,000 megawatts to get you. So you require 2 million renters to do that. So before you know it, the transaction costs are half of the actual project cost. You know, so that did not make for an attractive, you know, environment for bidders to submit around there. And like I also indicated, they then took comfort in the fact that let's not worry about this because there is a specific round that is coming for small projects. So you will see a lot more responsiveness in the small programs, because the small programs are mainly landfill gas, biomass, and so forth.
You know, one striking thing, I know we talk about the small project, but the striking thing about landfill gas is the environmental benefits out of it, isn't it?
Yes, Chair. Yes,
it may not be in full, but also remember you're going to the waste dumps and doing something, you know, to reduce whatever, you know, toxins are there. I'm just sensitizing that as a monitoring, just keep that at the back of our minds. I take into account what you're saying in any case for this purpose. Yeah.
Yeah, Chair, you're 100% right. There are specific benefits out of the landfill thing. Not so much from a greenhouse gas perspective. In other words, the extent to which, and I'm going to be a little bit controversial, but the extent to which you can mitigate adverse, you know, environmental impact on the greenhouse gas emissions is much, much smaller than the waste to energy component of that. In other words, you know, you want to start impacting land use. Let's give an example. In the KZN, well, not just the KZN, even in Joburg itself, the big concern is that the seven landfill sites that are used now are almost fully, you know, what is the word, they used up, they're full. Right, so what do? You declare another piece of land that could have been used for something else, for, you know, for landfill use, or do you find other incentives to convert that waste into energy and so take advantage of that opportunity. So in that you will see on the biomass program, on the small program, a component of that biomass is waste, right? And we didn't disaggregate, you know, to that level. But a big component of biomass is, you know, it's not just wood and you know, and what is the correct word for the stuff that the stuff that ticks?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, sorry, I was struggling for words there. Manure from pigs and so on, right? It's not so much that, it's the fact that there are tons and tons of waste in the urban areas that not only does it cause that methane gas problem on the landfill site, but it's an environmental, you know, a hazard that can be converted into energy currency. Yeah, so that is coming, HM.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, just on that point,
I mean, having spoken to a couple of potential biogas developers, I mean, what they've told me is that the maximum price that was offered under this was far too low to make it viable. But in fact, what is more viable is not so much to use it for electricity, but in fact to use it for LPG gas. And that's a possible source we should be looking at. The problem we're facing, though, is that you have to then work with municipalities and you have to get permission to use their landfills and you have to go through all of those processes. So that's what seems to be holding that whole thing up. But, I mean, biogas is something we should definitely be doing in South Africa. I mean, we really need to get onto it. So.
In other words, whilst we're focusing on 3, 7 to 5 megawatts and the the procurement, this is the beginning to provoke and trigger other options. And Panabella then must monitor that and see, you know, whether those other options, you know, would be live and kicking. I mean, we do interact with the municipalities through SALCA, for example, even if the department negotiates with them, but also we must play a role to ensure that, you know, issues that are raised by either Mr. Pan or Honorable Failing, we really knock at their doors, you know, and see that works. I mean, if you look at those 7, I know a couple of them in Joburg, you know, and they're huge. Now, you can imagine, you know, the multiple benefits if we could ensure that, you know, that route is also activated. Let's keep our tabs on that.
Maybe we must put a request for the department to invite us when they do the launching. Well, we don't want to get involved in your procurement or anything. And always tell them that launching of it and to hear the kind of input and the direction that it will be taken from them. We will not necessarily want it to be part of procurement. I think our part is oversight study.
Good emphasis, and I'm sure the department would be amenable to that. Over to you, Mr.
You know, thanks. I think it's the point is clear and it's well taken. Just to also alert, I was thinking aloud now that suddenly this is a grid electricity program, and then it has to be synchronized with the gas, but that's our mandate. That's what the department is about. We'll have to find a way of dealing with that, because otherwise, what happens is that you then look at the electricity opportunity, and it might, there's arbitrage with the gas opportunity, and which one makes more sense. You know, so we have to then decide, you know, that we have to design it in such a way that, you know, it does not, this one does not necessarily sterilize the other, and vice versa, and that it works. I mean, which is more critical, I suppose, is that if it's gas, then you want to use it. Gas to heating is a lot more efficient than gas to electricity, than electricity to heating.
Or industrial.
Yeah, or industrial. Yeah. Okay, so it's something that we'll have to think about, Chen, but I take the point. The question about local manufacturing the local manufacturing environment of this renewable energy program, and whether Window 1 on track, Chair, and maybe to link that with the jobs, right? And I'm going to be as frank as possible around this, is that we are starting to see clear picture in terms of the actual number of direct jobs. Remember, we have an implementation agreement that we signed for 20 years, and commitments are made by these different developers as to the jobs and all of that. So one is able to now quantify how many jobs one is going to get out of window one, out of window two, et cetera, out of the different technologies. What we don't see yet is, if you like, the secondary and tertiary jobs and so on. And unfortunately, I'm not able to respond to that as yet, but in another few months' time, we would have completed the socioeconomic impact outcome of the IRP generally, but specifically on the renewable energy thing, right? So at the moment, it's just numbers, right? But it's numbers presented by ignorant people like ourselves, basically. We just say, when it comes to construction, there will be 20,000 jobs. When it comes to the life cycle, there are 7,000 direct jobs that will be created. That's all I can tell you at this point. But as to what happens now on the manufacturing side, you know, this is basically the numbers that I've just given you are those that bidders commit to. Right? But where do they get the turbine? And if you say there's 60% local content, how many people get employed there? And what do those people that have been employed to do turbines, you know, do on the secondary side and so on and so forth? We're not able to, we'll only be able to do that once we have completed the socioeconomic impact assessment. But Che, one can also, on a, if you like, on a like-for-like basis, on an apples-to-apples basis, start comparing, for example, of the 46 billion rands that went into window one, how many direct jobs are bidders committing to? And one can then compare that, for example, to the, you know, the coal side and so on and so forth. And I must say, quite frankly, the numbers for, let's start with the negative. The negative is that the market misrepresented this. So the renewable energy program is not showing, you know, a massive multiplier in jobs relative to the coal sector. But having said that, that was the negative. Having said that, it definitely is showing a lot more jobs. So in other words, if you compare 46 billion rands and how many jobs it creates under out of this program, and you compare an equivalent 46 billion rands in coal and the number of jobs that it creates, there is no argument. Right? There's absolutely no argument in terms of that. But I think, say, in fairness, what we need to do is let's do, you know, a South African story properly, then we can be able to present it like that. At the moment, it's just, you know, it's intuitive. You're just seeing certain signs, but it's not scientific, you know, as yet, except for the fact that, yeah, the number of jobs that you are seeing here, I can put my head on the block, there definitely a lot more than what you see at Midupi in terms of direct jobs. Fine, the difference is that at Midupi they will take, you know, a much wider. So you have to be careful as well. To be like over the life of this thing, it's like, what, 6 years, 7 years construction program. These ones will be, you know, over 3 years, right? It'll be over.
Oh, Japan.
Okay. I just on the side, yeah, we did mention that Eskom is here, so somebody needs to protect Eskom. But yeah, so that's the point. The point is that you have to compare apples with apples, right? So we're seeing a bigger number, maybe two times or three times, right? But over a shorter period. And then the issue then becomes what happens on the secondary side, what are the spin-offs and so on, you know, in terms of local economic development and that. Then the last question, sir, you asked why Gauteng, KZN, and Mpumalanga, what prevented them submitting. Sir, and it's a very simple issue, we think. It's mainly because no one can compete against those are the three provinces in relation to the natural renewable energy resources. Right? So when it comes to wind, the Eastern Cape, the Western Cape by far, and to some extent the Northern Cape on the coastal side, right? Everything that's coastal and so on, I think, you know, tends to have a lot more of resources. Then the sun, solar irradiation in the Northern Cape by far the biggest. Then, you know, so one needs to find those specific or the relative advantages of these other provinces. For example, KZN and Mpumalanga, absolutely no doubt they're going to dominate the cogen, the renewable cogen segment because of the sugar and the paper industry. Right? So they will now start seeing a lot of development in that space, and nobody can, you know, stand against that because of that. But I think what we need to worry about is now Gauteng. Gauteng, you also have very serious, it's not, yeah, you got very serious land use issues. So it's not easy to find a land where you can just, you know, just, you know, what is it, the wood, that's fallow and all of that. Yeah, so you have those kind of issues. Yeah, so exactly. Then you start competing with other land users. Remember, so it's not just for energy, it's also for agriculture, but it's also for housing as well. And I think it's understandable that you're not necessarily able to do that. And then having said that, Chair, there are other initiatives to try and deal with that as well. It doesn't mean that it gets completely left out.
I'm sure Jared could do one of my favorites.
Waste energy.
With the three metros,
Tshwane,
Ruleni, and Joburg, look at the amount of waste they generate. Surely it's something that on the sidelines, you know, maybe if you have some interns, to give them a project to look into, you know. I mean, you said seven, you know, waste sites in landfill sites in Joburg only. Now with all of them, you know, let alone the other, your Kruger stops for the bay. And stuff, you know. So, okay. Sure.
Sure, maybe this is our second bite.
Yes.
As the responses were coming from the department, I agree with the department in regards to ESCOM not being part of the IPPs, but not for the reason that the department has given. I think for the reason that IPPs, in its very nature, the name IPP, makes them independent power producers from ESCOM. There's no any other independence they have other than from ESCOM, because ESCOM has been the sole power producer throughout, and it's a government-owned entity. Now, they will become private sector and independent from ESCOM. And I agree also with their reason for refusal to bring the documents to ESCOM, because they view ESCOM as a competitor. But the fact that the question that ESCOM cannot produce and sell, they are already doing it with the depleted source, the coal. They are already generating and distributing at the moment. I was asking my friends here from ESCOM, and he said, no, don't worry, man, let's wait for the ESCOM bill to pass, and then we can talk about that later. And on the issue of the different stakeholders, I appreciate the response from the department, but I wonder whether for purposes of skills and technology, that the Department of Sciences and Technology is not a key player there. I think they should become a key player also, for purposes of research, technology, and skills.
And Sanedi.
energy, I think, is part of the department. And therefore, their involvement is as much as the department is involved. They can take them as part of them as they go to the meetings. But I want us to pause and ask ourselves, I don't know if you have the answer now. You may not be having it, but if you don't have it, you can still get that answer in the next meeting. You know, as public representatives, we move around and address public. I just sit and say, if at some point I address people and at the end of it they say we would like to ask a few questions, and someone puts a question, that is like, how many megawatts is South Africa currently using to see to it that there is electricity? And how many do we need in the future to reach out to universal access? You know, I would not be in a position to can say that. I know it's some of the things that we take for granted, but I think it's information that is very important for us to know. We are talking about now the minister having given what authority for 3.8, yeah, for 3,725 of megawatts across different technologies to the and for production by the IPPs. But this is just a little contribution to a bigger picture. He was explaining to us what the megawatt means in terms of household electrification. But when you try to imagine what are we currently using, it should be enormous. If someone asked that question, I would not be able to answer. And if the department could be able, I know also that we cannot get an accurate figure because these things are changing from time to time as development is taking place. New houses getting built, other factories coming to the place, new mines getting discovered and so on. The amount is ever increasing. But an estimate of where are we and what is the projection towards the future with the building of, with the implementation of the IRP?
Thank you.
Any other follow up? Okay. Thanks. I think just the comment around the GST is well received. What perhaps we just need to indicate is that when we talk about the renewable energy IPP program, one has to also put it into some context in the broader government program of action. The work that is done around IPEP 2, right, the Industrial Policy Action Plan, particularly the segment that deals with the green economy, needs to be understood, you know, in its broader context. And that's where everybody else goes in. Remember, at this point, we're only talking about renewable energy and its connection into the grid. But there's also renewable energy in other forms, right? Solar water heating, energy efficiency, and so on and so forth, right? And at IPEP, where everybody participates, including the Department of Science and Technology, including, you know, the SANEDI reference and so on, that's where all of these, if you like, issues are dealt with. And then the positions are then translated into the program. And so that's how you need to do. Like, there is a high-level government, you know, program around that with DTI and the laws they put in place, the designations, the incentives, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, the local economic development package in the renewable energy IPP program is largely driven by the DTI. So they're the ones who do the research and say you cannot prescribe anything less than 50% for, you know, local content for wind turbines, for example, because they've done some research and they know what's possible and so on. And then it goes into that. And
then at the same time, the Department of Science and Technology is looking at how one can cut into those supply chains, you know, through the different initiatives. Doesn't mean that it does not get done. It's just that, you know, on this program, you know, they would not, you know, be directly sitting there at the Department of Science and Technology. I thought I should just let you around that. And then I think the other point is also very relevant, and I'm glad that it was just sensitized, the fact that the IRP is not the renewable energy program. The IRP is the renewable energy program and a whole lot of others. At this point, we're only focusing on the renewable energy program and the other projects to deal with the thousands of megawatts that we require as a country are at different stages of readiness or of implementation. And one of the biggest issues that we are resolving in the short term is in relation to the price part, and I did mention that. So that one is able to say, as I implement the IRP, I'm aware of the financial implications for the country and for the electricity tariff, just so that you have, you know, that you manage those risks that we've seen, you know, in other segments. Right? And I'm going to mention it now, you know, where you go and procure roads, and then you have not settled the issue around the funding model for it. Right? So we have to get to that point where we say, here is the funding model for electricity infrastructure, and we deal with that issue, and then we can go back and procure in a certain, well, or with certainty. Right? So it's deliberately lagging behind those other programs in the IRP. I think the big issue there is, and well, everybody knows it's nuclear. Right? That's the next one in the critical path. And then the decisions around gas and coal as well. So those programs are not being ignored. It's just that there's a whole lot of groundwork that is happening behind the scenes in order to sort out the funding, you know, options that we have. Then you will see determinations around, you know, all of those other programs as well. I think that was well spotted. Yeah. Oh, then the megawatt here. If you read the Business Day, I think once a week, but in very small print, when they do like some statistical analysis, they also indicate how much electricity has been consumed. Yeah, and I think yesterday was something like 34,000 megawatts. That's how much we deployed, which is 34,000 megawatts. And if you then you add some 10% of that, let's say 4,000 megawatts as reserve, you get to 37,000 megawatts. Then you get to some 2,000 megawatts that is out of commission for different reasons. You get to the 40,000 megawatts, more or less. And that's how, you know, you understand whether we are hitting the ceiling or not. Then going into the future, the IRP says another 40,000 megawatts. So by 2030, we'll get around 80,000 megawatts. So we're doubling capacity in the next 18 years, yeah. According to growth projections. And the growth projections that we're seeing now, I think it's something like, what, 1.2% or something. It's very small, but we are growing. So even though we might be in some, or might have been in a recession, the electricity demand is growing by about 1.2%. Whereas the projection, I think, was about 2.2 thereabouts. So we're not growing as fast, but we definitely are growing. That's why we're not in the dark right now.
Thank you very much, Pane. This has been very, very informative, and I think we hit the nail on the head by just getting an update, because this is an ongoing thing, and the kind of questions and comments that are coming are obviously indicative of the fact that we need to relate even the update on Windows 2 to a couple of other things. They said IRP is iterative, so let's be alert, honorable members, that at some stage we need to get an update on it as well. I think the two-year cycle is this year, so let's keep that in mind. But just in conclusion, quick, if the independent review report would cover certain aspects, then I would propose some very brief Nyana summary report from you for this, so that we start building our files, because this is a very interesting at an area that you should have keen interest on, all of the members. Not just a PowerPoint presentation. It's not that helpful. Though it's helpful for now, but we need something that would help us to maintain our memories and make reference to, particularly in the Deslau, if you could use it, you know, anywhere when people ask you about it, because people would have expectations when you find that, you know, 1 megawatt is equal to how much. You know, 5 megawatts is 100 million rand investment. The age of the bidders conference and the interest was one of the issues that was of concern. Come again?
1 megawatt is 1 million.
Something like that. The inclusion of state-owned enterprises is another area, and also what could have been generated by ideally the 53 bidders if they were successful, even what is happening on Windows 2. Remember, Minister Peter said we were oversubscribed, and here are figures now corroborating that. Local manufacturing, I'm sure we'll share the outcomes of the first energy public meeting on that. The MAR mechanism, when we meet the standing committees, we'll raise that as one of the key areas, because, I mean, if we do not check on that, we might as well start packing our bags. Of concern is the technology, 100% foreign technology, which Sanedi did indicate, and I'm sure one of the members will keep a keen eye on that. For the future, well, the small projects, in the forthcoming round, we'll be very keen to get an exposure on that, because it gets closer to the small and medium businesses, ideally. Of course, taking into account the cost, you know. But one other thing that the Rapani we have raised, which is going to be of keen interest, which I'm sensitizing members, is coal generation, because that's an area we need to be, you know, looking into. Remember last year we said we invited ITC to take us through green industries. Suppose now that there's EPUB 3 and that is slow, we need to explore that if we have a spare half a day, you know, because that balance, you know, I know the department does interact because they are part of the economic cluster, they do that, but also on our side, you know, to ensure that there's, you know, adequate generation of energy and electricity is one thing, but also to link it to other areas, particularly, you know, the green industries. Eskom, if you remember, in the recent presentation, one of the things we requested is that we should be made part of the community that gives these updates. You know, I'm just indicating to Ladislaus' point. You know, I know they said it's there in the website, but I'm sure you'd appreciate the extent to which honorable members are able to frequent various websites, let alone just their website. So if there could be a very creative way of linking us, you know, so that we get the updates. Not as frequent as some of the, you know, industrial sectors. I mean, they get things, they get the updates on a daily basis. I'm sure honorable members. Yeah, twice a day, that's not what you want, you know. But at least let's have an idea. Only to say this is so much against the peak, which is 43, né? And also the, you know, the normal 38, 39. You see, that's what I'm sure Mama Tindy would like to know, you know, how far are we in that time now, you know. The trends and things, maybe, if possible, on a weekly or fortnightly or monthly basis, whichever, you know, is feasible for us, you know, more electronically. I'm sure it will cost that much. And then let us know, because it should trigger you maybe to even ask one or two further questions just by SMSing, what about this, what about that. And on that note, let me thank everyone. And next week, we're getting PetroSA to take us through the strategic plan. Remember, we have to shift it because their day is clashed with their trip to overseas, and also the department, we need to formalize now its annual performance plan as well as the midterm strategic plan next week. Thanks very much. The meeting stands adjourned. Of course, today starts the galloping.
Economic development in Barcelona. Yeah. And we're part of